Australia is, of course, not alone in having an ongoing, endless struggle with its own identity. Are we still the successful, multicultural nation we thought ourselves to be? And how much racism is there bubbling beneath the surface, often encouraged by political leaders, past and present? And how do we reconcile the disadvantage experienced by the Indigenous community when it comes to health, education, and the criminal justice system, all topics we deal with on an ongoing basis on the Little Wireless program? Antoinette Latouf has written a book about racism, the racism she has felt in her own life, but also the many ways that racism continues to damage relations between people of colour and white Australia. And she has a few tips on how to deal with it when you come across it in yourself and in the people around you. Antoinette is a journalist and co-founder of the Media Diversity Australia. She's now the author of the book, How to Lose Friends and Influence White People, and it's published by Vintage Books. Welcome to Late Night Live, Antoinette. First of all, tell me a bit about yourself.
About myself? Gee, where do I start? So as you mentioned, I'm a journalist. I grew up in Western Sydney. My parents came to Australia as refugees from the Middle East. And since I was a young girl, I knew I wanted to be a journalist, even though I didn't really have access to anybody who had been to university or had a profession or belong to any of, I guess, the pillars of democracy in Australia, you know, media, government, judiciary. And so my experience and the experiences I share in this book are both personal, but they look at sort of the structural impediments to people of colour to really participating fully in our democracy and really having access to a voice and power.
I think we should also point out that you've worked at 10/7, SBS, and here at the ABC.
That's right, yes. So I have been a journalist for over a decade, and Media Diversity Australia was formed around 5 years ago. And the purpose of that was, after working several years in the media, what I noticed was that it continued to be very much monopolized by Anglo-Australians, and you can walk down a street in Sydney or in any city around the country, and it looked nothing like what newsrooms looked like. And I just thought the media has to do better in not only reflecting its population, but also in having a kind of a long, hard look at itself in terms of its role in perpetuating racist stereotypes or, you know, maintaining structural racism. So that's how that advocacy group was set up.
And I know that you've experienced a lifetime of, well, casual racism, haven't you, from low expectations at high school to watching other people of colour being, got at on social media.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've experienced individual acts of racism. And so that's when people say awful things to you, when you're denied access to things. As you know, and I recall an instance when in primary school, everybody was invited to a birthday party except for me. The girl at the time said to me, "I'm so sorry, you can't come to my party because my mum said Arabs aren't to be trusted." And so that's just sort of, that's the daily occurrence of racism. But I talk about racism in less about kind of individual acts of saying, saying the N-word or calling Arabs terrorists or even attempting to hide racism through humour, and more about how it manifests in power structures and how that plays out. Like you mentioned earlier, Indigenous health outcomes, education, Indigenous deaths in custody, over-incarcerations, they're the structural manifestations of racism. That's well beyond what somebody may yell out of a car window when, you know, if they see a person of colour walking down the street.
So there is an ongoing mismatch between our perceptions of ourselves as a nation and the reality.
I think so. Australia likes to pat itself on the back as the most successful multicultural country in the world. And I guess my book questions that because on the surface, if you look at our population makeup, yes, we are one of the most multicultural countries in the world. But when you think of our diverse populations and what access they have to opportunity in this country, and I highlight high court, politics, media, business, art institutions, it's almost as though the White Australia policy is still in place because people of colour just don't have access. And some may argue, oh, well, but that's just because the best person gets the job. And it's like, well, it's impossible that there isn't, for example, a single person of colour that is worthy of a job at a media board level, or that a single person of colour has never been worthy of a job on the High Court. There has never been a High Court judge who is Indigenous or non-European in Australia's 200-plus year history. It's very hard to argue that there hasn't been a single person who's deserved that opportunity.
We recently had Chandran Nair on the program talking about the need to address white privilege on a global scale. It's not a term that you like to use. Why?
Sometimes there are words that are used so often in discourse around race or even on social media that it immediately elicits defensiveness before people even have even really consider it. So I talk about white privilege through other means. Like in one part of the book, I look at Aldi shopping trolleys and shopping tokens to try and break down how privilege manifests. And so, you know, I use a little, I go through, somebody has a person of colour, for example, has a token and they try and put it in a shopping trolley. It just so happens the shopping trolley they have, this token, one out of four tokens, just don't work. They've done nothing to deserve this. Three other people walk through and they waltz through straight into Aldi. They get to the special buy section. They're happy. They do their shopping and out they go. And so what I have tried to do, and I won't go into too much detail how it plays out, what structural barriers are, what privilege is, what equitable access is, but I've tried to veer away from that word only because it's so loaded. And people get really defensive. And there have been studies which show when Anglo people are shown examples of privilege, rather than accept privilege, they dig deep as they can, to circumstances in their life or in their past where they've had hardship. So it can often elicit guilt. So when confronted with instances of white privilege, the studies showed that people would be like, oh, but you know, but I have a single mom and I have a really big mortgage and dad was a drunk, and go through everything that could possibly minimize their privilege rather than actually sit with what that means and what that looks like.
Remind everyone that I'm talking to you and Antoinette Latouf, the co-founder of Media Diversity Australia. Okay, if white privilege stops people thinking or forces them into defensivism, how do we get around that?
Well, there's some of the things I talk about in my book. So I go through things like white privilege, white guilt, white shame, the different kind of responses people have when they are faced with the uncomfortable truth of racism or the ongoing impacts of racism in Australia since colonisation, the modern manifestations, because a lot of people like to think, oh, that's something that happened before, but I'm not like that. And so interestingly, there's lots of different tools that people can use if they are trying to influence somebody in the race and equality space. One thing, for example, is humour. Using humour can often bring people's defensiveness down. Unfortunately, for journalists like you and I, using facts often doesn't work, which we've seen with COVID misinformation, with even the US election with Trump, and that all the misinformation surrounding that you can have all the facts, and if somebody refuses to believe that, facts alone won't do it. So it's about little things like using language, using a person's name, and personalizing your experiences rather than It's like a relationship counseling. You did this and you made me feel like this and that's why you're this, often gets defensiveness rather than I have experienced this and from my perspective this. And so what I do is I look through different tools of influence and apply it to the racial sphere and go, this is what social psychology tells us about the human brain and how we respond when we feel guilty, when we are ashamed, when we feel attacked. And ways to circumvent that.
Antoinette, you talk about the many shades of white in the discussions about race, but for those who want to be white allies, what tips do you have for them?
I think one of the first thing is to accept that privilege isn't a dirty word, and wherever you are, wherever you are placed, if you are a middle-aged white man called Tom who was so happened to be born into wealth, there's nothing to feel guilty about. Just own who you are and what you are, and then see what relative power and privilege you have to listen to and amplify the voices of people of colour. So the first thing we all need to do is A, accept that we all have different privileges and power and that we can all be a little bit racist. People so often spend a huge amount of time denying that they could ever have a racist thought and say things like, oh, but I don't see colour and I just hire the best person for the job and I think, oh, I don't understand this. And it's like, well, let's just accept that we can all be racist. We all have different starting points, and then own where you are and see what you can do to help further the core, help amplify and support people of colour, not to speak for them. But also the other thing I would say is to understand that sometimes it'll come at a cost, which is part of the How to Lose Friends part of my book. Sometimes it comes at a cost to you because it makes people uncomfortable who don't want to be part of the change. It may mean that you put a person of colour or an Indigenous person before you or suggest them for a job promotion, or you. It sometimes means taking a step back. There's so much more in the book, but there's some, I guess, some tools and tips that I can share.
There was a time when there was a tendency to talk about white Australians as the hub culture, and even in the glory days of multiculturalism, it had to be observed that there was often deep divisions between racial groups.
Absolutely. And that's something that's really under-researched and not really spoken about in an Australian context. There's a lot of, Indigenous and, versus white kind of narrative. But one thing I do explore, and something I witnessed in my own Arabic-speaking community around Black Lives Matter, was a lot of anti-Indigenous and anti-Black racism. And some may argue, but how can I be, a racist if I too am a migrant or a refugee? But that exists and sometimes quite profoundly and quite detrimentally in Australia. But unfortunately, the small amount of literature that we do have about that all still suggests that the most toxic and damaging form of racism is anti-Black, anti-Indigenous racism. And sometimes more settled migrant groups like Italians, Greeks, and arguably even Lebanese are quick to want to distance themselves from either Indigenous groups or more newly arrived African groups so as to take the attention off themselves. And so it's a bit of a, if you can't beat them, join them, racism bandwagon, which is one we should just, other people of colour should just not be jumping on.
Antoinette, decades ago when I started doing this program, I invented a hypothetical listener and called her Gladys. I mention this because I want you to introduce us to your hypothetical Gail.
My hypothetical Gail. So often when we talk about power structures in Australia, it's in the prism of a pale, stale male. When we talk about feminism, feminists are still, third wave feminists are still vying for access to boardrooms, positions of power, all noble and important pursuits. The problem I have with a certain type of feminism in Australia that seems to be, I would say, kind of mainstream feminism, is that it is very distinct. It is white, it is middle class, and it is often to the exclusion of Indigenous women and other people of colour. And while these women will roll their eyes at pale, male, stale, I've added a fourth dimension to the kind of rhyming, this rhyming reason, and that's Gale. And Gale is much the same as pale, stale male, you know, we'll call him Tom or Andrew or whatever we want to call him, because she maintains racist attitudes, and her feminism isn't intersexual, and she shuts the door behind Gale types to exclude women of colour and the most marginalised women in Australia, which are Indigenous Australian women.
Well, you make the point that Gale might take to the streets when one of her own is murdered, but oft stays silent when the victim is Indigenous.
Absolutely. We've seen some of the most high-profile cases where there are vigils and countless media articles and GoFundMe campaigns, and every woman's life matters and every death is important. But you do have to question when the only deaths, whether it be domestic violence or random acts of violence against Australian women, when the empathy and care is only if a woman looks and sounds like them. And that's unfortunately what we see in Australia with the Gale phenomena.
In the time that you've been working in the media, you've seen women of colour persecuted for speaking their mind. Indeed, it's happened to you, but I'm thinking, say, of Yasmin Abdel-Magid and Yumi Stimes.
Yes, it's interesting that getting Yasmined is now actually an academically recognised term for the fear women of colour with a public profile in Australia face, because unfortunately precedence has shown that any so-called inverted commas or so-called mistake. What we've seen with both Yasmin and Yumi Stimes, the backlash was so disproportionate. The impact on their careers, their mental health and their safety was so enormous, and yet we've seen atrocious behaviour by other people in the media, sometimes blatantly racist, sexist, or in the case of Alan Jones, found to have helped incite the Cronulla riots. You know, Alan Jones says things like shoving socks down Prime Minister's throat, another one needs a backhander, like the most vile commentary, and they not only continue to have their jobs, they get pay rises. So what that does is it has a silencing effect on women of colour, or it just drives them out of kind of considering a career in either media or politics because they know they're going to be unfairly scrutinised.
Well, talking about scrutiny, I want you to briefly tell me the story of you versus Kerry Ann Kennelly.
Well, this is an interesting one because we weren't talking about race or representation or anything. We were on breakfast television a couple of years ago when I was working for Network 10 at the time, and so was Kerry Ann. She had the on-air stoush with Yumi Stimes a few months prior, where Yumi Stimes rightly pointed out that the comments she was making about Indigenous sexual assault were racist and they were upheld by ACMA, the broadcasting body. But the vitriol directed at Yumi for saying that was very fresh in my mind. So I'm sitting on the same couch as Kerry Ann talking about something really innocuous like emojis or something. Kerry Ann decided to then look at me and look at my outfit and ask me live on television, had I forgotten to wear my pants, referring to the clothes that I was wearing because she must have deemed them to be short or I don't know. I tried to laugh it off thinking we're live on television, we're colleagues. I can't react badly because I know that the backlash would be disproportionate. She then continues to say, oh, well, then that means, you know, you must be thirsty. In the conversation prior, somebody, Angela Bishop, another panellist, had mentioned that thirsty in local vernacular and slang on the internet meant that you were horny or desiring sexual attention. So then she kind of took a second, and which I again tried to laugh off and deflect. But in that moment, I decided not to react and tell her what I really thought, that as she was trying to sort of put down another woman on live television, that rather than, you know, empower and support a colleague, she tried to ridicule me live on air or slut shame me as it's known. But I knew in that moment that I would come off worse, that I would probably be reprimanded. And it was such a clearly unfair situation, and I was so clearly targeted by her. But I had to go, okay, what happened to Yumi? What happened to Yasmin? Okay, be quiet, Antoinette, just be quiet. And so I literally, you can see me on air biting my tongue. I bite my lip back and I take a deep breath but I felt humiliated. I felt it was so unprofessional, but I just had to kind of cop it.
Well, belatedly, you got a sort of a reluctant apology. Now, back to Chandran Nair about his book, Dismantling Global White Privilege. He talked about losing friends as a consequence of his book. Are you prepared for the same fate? People don't like having their flaws exposed, do they?
They don't. Hence the cheeky title of my book, How to Lose Friends and Influence White People, which is a little swipe or a little adaptation of Dale Carnegie's, very famous How to Win Friends and Influence People. In his book, one of his most quoted bits of advice is to not condemn or criticize or complain. I'm doing all of them in my book. however, it's actually done with a lot of jest and a lot of warmth and a lot of humour and with a lot of hope, and also coming to the table with solutions. And I think that's what's really empowering, that yes, I talk about the loss of friends and how this will get some people offside, being a champion for racial equality. However, the book is really practical and it has a lot of hope. And I wouldn't have written it if I didn't believe that there was an appetite in Australia for change. And that there is a desire to be and do better. There is something in a post-Black Lives Matter, post-pandemic world where I think people are seeking solutions. I'm hoping to be able to provide some.
Antoinette, in the moments we've got left, tell me about Media Diversity Australia.
It's essentially a not-for-profit run by working journalists and media professionals. We all have our industry jobs, but we wanted to ensure we were part of some solutions and change. And so it does research on the diversity of the industry. It has paid internships for entry-level Indigenous journalists and other people of colour, mentorship programs, training. It's essentially coming to the industry with solutions, because, again, it's really easy to be frustrated and angry at the problem. But it's a way to go, we know it's not good enough, we want to be part of the solutions, and here are a variety of programs and options to do that.
Thank you very much for coming on, Antoinette. I've been talking to Antoinette Latouf, a journalist and author of, the book we've been talking about is How to Lose Friends and Influence White People, published by Vintage Books, but she's also co-founder of Media Diversity Australia. Good on you, Antoinette.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.